Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture in the Senate Occasional Lecture Series. We continue our bumper year in 2011, and today it's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Mick Dodson. He's Director of the National Centre for Indigenous Studies at the ANU, Professor at Law at the ANU College of Law, and a host of other posts. Until recently, he was a member of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and he contributed to the crafting of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. He's a man of very many firsts, and I'd probably take the whole time for the lecture if I went through all of them, but amongst them, first Indigenous Australian to receive a law degree, which he did at Monash University, and our first Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. So I was reminded that this room is probably quite familiar to you from your stints before Senate Estimates Committees, which I'm sure you're relieved that you no longer have to do. For us, the first is that Mick is the first Australian of the year to address us in the Senate Lecture Series, so that's a great thing for us. His topic is one of supreme importance, the constitutional recognition of Indigenous Australians. And I ask you to join me in welcoming him to the podium. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rosemary, ladies and gentlemen. I would like at first to acknowledge the first Australians on whose ancestral lands we meet. And I would also like to acknowledge them for the many thousands of years they've been in careful possession of this land and the way in which they've sustainably utilised its resources. And I also want to pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Now, ladies and gentlemen, many of you may know of a panel that's scooting around the country at the moment that's talking to people about constitutional recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians. And what I want to do today in this address is to examine, among other things, what might be the recipe for a successful referendum and how we might mix the ingredients of that recipe to both achieve the symbolic recognition in our constitution that many of us desire, but also how we might make substantive change that is required to the Constitution to reset the relationship positively between the first Australians and the rest of the country. Now, this expert panel that I've mentioned will report to government in December, by the 1st of December this year. And that report will no doubt advise the government on how to give effect to Indigenous constitutional recognition, and they're required also to report on the level of support from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and from the broader community. And they have a terms of reference which requires them to lead a broad national consultation and community agreement engagement program to seek the views of a wide spectrum of the community. including those who live in rural and regional areas, and I would add remote areas, which is a lot of our mob. They're also to work closely with organisations such as the Australian Human Rights Commission, the new National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, and Reconciliation Australia, all of whom have existing expertise and are able to engage on this issue. They're also required to raise awareness about the importance of this step of Indigenous constitutional recognition, and they're meant to support ambassadors in the campaign to bring or to generate broad public awareness and discussion. The government's also said to the panel that in performing their task, they need to have regard to key issues raised by the community in relation to Indigenous constitutional recognition and the form of constitutional change and the approach to a referendum that's likely to achieve widespread support, and also report on the have regard to the implications of any proposed changes to the constitution, and finally to the glee of constitutional law experts to get their advice. I hasten to add I'm not a constitutional law expert, but being a lawyer I had to read it at some stages way back in the distant past, although I've been looking at it more carefully recently since this process has got underway. So what I want to do today in light of that sort of introduction is to examine some of the options that may be available for us in this proposed referendum, but also to pose some questions. I'm not sure if I'm in a position to answer these questions, but I think we need to ask them. And the first question is perhaps, and that these aren't necessarily in logical order, but you know, what do we need to do to make this succeed, and how do we make that happen? Many of those who were involved in the 67 referendum, which is the most successful referendum in Australian constitutional history, are no longer with us. But we can learn from the processes that they went through, I think, to try and maximise our chances of succeeding this time around. But perhaps there's a more pressing question we need to ask of ourselves before we get into the nitty-gritty of the options that might be available to us. And it's this question. Will this referendum or any of its propositions bring us close together? Indeed, will it unify us? And perhaps in other words, what exactly is the purpose of this exercise? Will it deal with what we Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders refer to as unfinished business? Indeed, should it deal with that unfinished business? Or should we regard it as the beginning process where we're looking to start now and refine into the future? I think the terms of reference give us some insight into what might be the purpose of this exercise, but to me it's not all that clear. And I said, you know, I'm not sure if I can answer those questions. But I do think they're there are some key matters we need to found this process on, or to put a philosophical basis to this endeavour, the why we're doing this part. And if we're going to rearrange and reset the relationship between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, us, the First Nations peoples of this wonderful country of ours, is this the way to do it? Is this how we're going to solidify, unify, reset our affairs with the rest of the country for those who come here since 1788? Now, I agree that this referendum should be about recognition. And I think perhaps we can all agree about that. But it cannot just be about recognition. And I think just doing that would be an enormously wasted opportunity for us. But what should be the core of this exercise? And the elements I speak of go beyond mere recognition. Recognition, of course, is very important, but we must go beyond that this time. And recognition itself is one of the key elements. It's the first of the three. But I'd like to put it more elaborately, because it must include an acknowledgement in the Constitution that we, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, were here first. And not only here first, we were in possession of the country. When the British sovereignty, the British Crown asserted its sovereignty. Over all our lands. And if we recognise that we are in possession at that time, if it's recognised, it must also be acknowledged and recognised that the place was taken from us without our consent. And that was wrong, and that question has never, ever been addressed. And this fact of recognition, or fact of acknowledgement, is really acknowledging our status, the status of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, as the first peoples of this land, which would enable us to build a platform to build on, in my opinion. The second key element I want to mention goes to the question of identity. Not just our Aboriginal identity, our Torres Strait Islander identity. This question of identity is about all of us. It's about our identity as Australians. And so far as we are concerned, the first peoples of this land. We want our identity to be protected and respected within our legal and constitutional arrangements, within our nation state. And it's about us as a nation valuing the fact of these ancient identities and what that stands for us, a modern nation in the modern internet world. Somewhere I suggest our constitution isn't at the moment. The final key element, I think, that should found our thinking on this referendum question is to do with citizens and citizenship. You know, we, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples of this country, are not full citizens at present under our constitution. Our constitution allows the first Australians to be treated by the parliament with racially discriminatory laws, laws that don't respect principles of equality, and laws that don't respect principles of non-discrimination. So we're not equal citizens. So the question has to be part of our thinking. I'm sure most Australians don't want that citizen minus approach to be part of our constitutional arrangements. So I ask you to think about those elements when you think about eventually casting a vote on this question. So how do we achieve this? You know, Williams and Hume have given us some idea in a paper they've published. And they say the following. Firstly, that the question has to have bipartisan support. There has to be genuine popular engagement generating ownership for the populace, for those of our citizens who are entitled to vote. There has to be education around the question. And there has to be a great deal of clarity of proposal and the message. And there has to be a good referendum process. Now, the 44 referenda we've had in this country, only 8 have succeeded. I think you'd be safe to say if you examined all of those that failed, that one ingredient of this recipe at least had been breached. So I want to talk a bit about those things in looking at some of the practical issues that confront us. At the same time, trying to speak of some of the opportunities that this constitutional referendum could afford us. And I want to look at the whole gamut of possibilities, at least the ones I've looked at, from what I call the very minimalist position to the Maximus position. I'm not even sure if that's a word, but if it isn't, Macquarie, take note, I've just invented a new word. But it's what I call in your wildest dream stuff. I want to firstly reject a minimalist approach, and my preference is for incremental change with a view to long-term goals. One of the things we shouldn't do, and what Williams and Humes should inform us, is we shouldn't be running the local government referendum question with this question. Just don't do it. It's dumb, and it's going to increase the chances that both questions will fail. And there'll be a lot of arguments about that, but if the Parliament insists that that's what happens, we've got to make sure that it's clearly distinguishable. The two questions are clearly distinguishable from each other, because they're both talking about recognition of local government and recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So I don't think a proposal for local government should be tied with this referendum question, because it muddies the waters of two proposals that are quite different. And I, you know, won't accept arguments. I know I'll get overridden, but I won't accept arguments of practicality and economy, because it's something I want to say later. I don't think those sorts of questions should inhibit us in really bringing our constitution back to life, getting it out of the 1890s and getting it into the 21st century. Because we as a nation need to drag this instrument into the internet globalised age. And in particular, we need to think about how we accommodate the developments in the recognition and protection of the rights and interests of the world's Indigenous peoples that's occurring internationally through the United Nations system and through other international forums. Because what's happening internationally, and we like to be part of it globally when it comes to trade and commerce and economics and politics, but we're not very good at engaging internationally when it comes to things like our rights, and particularly the rights of Indigenous peoples. But Indigenous peoples are worldwide repositioning themselves within the nation states that they live in today, particularly in light of the overwhelming adoption by the UN General Assembly of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Now, Australia, belatedly, Australia voted against it, one of the four nations that voted against it in the General Assembly, but has since reversed its position on that and has now endorsed the declaration. But we shouldn't be left behind in bringing it to reality here at home for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And I think in this context, in this pursuit, if you like, we've got to abandon our old settler colonial societal thinking and come with a good heart to the task of resetting the relationship in line with what is now, through this declaration, the global standard. And I think the education component of the awareness raising should include talking about terminology, particularly as it's used in the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. A declaration that in the history of the United Nations has achieved the biggest ever yes vote, a bit like our 67 referendum. So this is what the international community supports as the standard. We shouldn't be dragging the chain. Now, of course, all of these things have it's a fact of life we have lawyers. and lawyers will argue about the meaning of these things, as they have done. It's what lawyers do. but I don't think that those things are... their concerns are insurmountable and unachievable, particularly for Australians. I think we can achieve just about anything if we set our minds to it, and as I say, come with a good heart, we'll do it. And having enjoined, for example, the use of the term peoples, peoples in international law has a significant meaning. It means that you have a right to self-determination. But Australia has endorsed the declaration. It uses that term. And of course the term is being used by the National Indigenous Body, the new National Congress of Australia's First Peoples. And of course it invokes things that I said that we're pretty shy about talking about, or are turn-offs to us when we start talking about human rights or rights and rights and interests. And there is, I accept, a significant portion of the population that are antagonistic towards talking about this stuff. But we've got to overcome that if we're fair dinkum about resetting relationships in this country. And we also have to be game enough to talk about the terms like race, racism, racial. You know. These are outmoded, outdated concepts. They're potentially inflammatory to the debate, but above all, we should have a discussion and abandon this stuff. You know, we shouldn't be talking about race in our constitution. This is discredited language. It's being used in a context that's no longer valid or relevant. We talk more about cultural and ethnic difference these days. That's got nothing to do with race. Because, after all, we're all members, me, you, people across the oceans, on other parts of the planet. We're all members of the human race. So we shouldn't be frightened in the process to talk about these things. Now, there has been talk about a preamble, and even, heaven forbid, in my view, a statement of values in the process thus far. Firstly, I think we should tell the panel, forget about a statement of values. We're not ready for that. We weren't ready for it 10 years ago, and I think it's going to be more than 10 years before we're ready. And that's another ingredient. If you put into that recipe, it will cock up the cake. We don't need to do that now. And we don't need, as I said, just to have a preamble. You know, some lawyers, and I'm one of them, say, well, people say stick something in the preamble. We say, well, no, there's no preamble. You know, we'd have to create a new preamble. Constitution doesn't have a preamble. What might be considered a preamble is an act of the British Parliament, the British Imperial Parliament of 1901. Some lawyers take a different view. But as I said, that's the nature of lawyers. Three lawyers in a room, you've got five legal opinions. So it shouldn't just be that. And I think I've already indicated if we're going to have a statement of reconciliation, I've indicated my preference of what it ought to contain, and that ought to be in a new preamble. And there are also lawyers who argue that, well, if you want to insert a preamble, you don't have to have a referendum. So that's another issue. Are we wasting our time worrying about the preamble? But the lawyers aren't agreed on this, and ultimately it's probably a question for them. For a bunch of lawyers in another building not far from here. So I think we should forget about having just a preamble, and shouldn't muddy the waters with idea of a statement of values. And I say that about the statement of values because it, you know, why put that question in with this question? It just will open the floodgates. Everybody, you know, will want something in there. Might be about their Christian heritage or about the influence of migrants or about some other issue that we're never ever going to agree on, because the list is endless. And this could really derail the focus on the question we're trying to deal with here, is the recognition of the first Australians. And, you know, if we want to do that down the track, there'll be other opportunities to have that debate. Perhaps when we become an inclusive republic with a new constitution. But that's not what we're on about at the moment. And some people, again lawyers, argue about the justiciability of the words in a preamble. I think we should trust our High Court on that question. I think in dealing with legal issues like this, I'd prefer them to the Parliament. So that, a preamble of recognition, would be both symbolic and address the first key element of my proposition. But what about substantive changes in the Constitution? Now, there are two highly offensive provisions in our Constitution. One is Section 25, which gives the Parliament the power to disenfranchise members of a particular race. And the other is subsection 26 of section 51, part of which was repealed in the 1967 referendum to remove reference to Aboriginal natives. I forget the exact words, but certainly Torres Strait Islanders weren't mentioned. because they were exception. The Commonwealth couldn't make laws with respect to Aboriginal people. The reference was removed. So the federal government now has that power. And this is the power that allows them, on at least five occasions in the last two decades, to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act and pass racially discriminatory laws against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders only. I should add, it's never ever been used. That power's never been used to discriminate against members of any other race, bearing in mind what I said earlier about this. It's only ever been used to discriminate against Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. So they're the two offending sections. Should we deal with both of them? I think we've got to do something substantive. Should we just repeal 25? Leave it for another day to what we might put in there in its place? Should we repeal subsection 26 of section 51? I say yes. Some will say, well, what happens to all those laws that were passed under that power? I mean, prior to 1967, the federal government passed something like 48 separate pieces of legislation that had all to do about the affairs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So prior to 67, it wasn't really... The federal parliament has never been without power to make laws for First Australians. But some say, well, the laws will fall over that have been passed under that power. I hope some of them do, like the Northern Territory Emergency Response Legislation. But others that have been of some, or arguably of some benefit to us, like the Native Title Act, should stand. But I think there's sufficient precedent in the Constitution to save those things, to preserve those things. There's already precedent there at Federation to save state constitutions, state laws, etc. So perhaps we just replace that 26 with a simple statement that says, for the peace, order and good government of the nation, the federal parliament's empowered to make laws for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Or we could say to make beneficial laws which would carry the message, well, we're not talking about racial discrimination here. I mean, repealing Section 25 isn't really going to do any damage. It's never, ever been used in 110 years of the Constitution. It's hardly ever even been referred to in judicial pronouncements. I think up until 1978, there'd been three mentions of it. as asides, irrelevancies to judgments. But it's not a provision we've sought to use to disadvantage or to disenfranchise people who happen to be from a different cultural or ethnic background. So why have this offensive piece of draftsmanship in our constitution? It's an embarrassment to us. We should get rid of it. I need to conclude soon. I think I've got 5 minutes. It hasn't given me the pink note yet. But look, the maximum position would include a new section 105B, which would allow the federal government and the states and territories to enter agreements with representatives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, primarily to deal with, but not exclusively, but primarily to deal with the unfinished business which is around status, identity, citizenship, recognition. And finally, to give us some time to discuss things, I mentioned earlier that we really don't have much knowledge, unless you happen to be a constitutional lawyer or a law student. We don't have much knowledge of our constitution. You know, a recent poll said that something like 58%, I think, don't quote me on the figure, but it was that high, it was a majority of Australians think we have a right to bear arms in our constitution. I mean, it sends a message to me we know more about what the Yanks have got in their constitution than we know about our own. So I think we've got to bring, as I said, bring our constitution to life, bring it into the 20th century. We should be having more frequent referenda. We should be examining this instrument and saying, this, it's time to bring this into the Facebook and the Twitter generation. This is what Iceland's doing. Iceland is throwing their constitution out, and they're bringing it in the 21st century, and the consultation process includes government running stuff through for comment through Twitter and Facebook and other ways of getting to people through the internet. It's not about, you know, town hall meetings, although they're doing that as well, but not solely. You know, it's not about newspapers, it's not about politicians getting up. It's about the people saying, "Well, look, this is what we want." And I think I don't think I'm. You know, I hope nobody's out there saying Mick's lost his marbles here. But I think we should take our constitution back, take it back from the politicians, and take it back from the court, you know, and say, look, we want these things done because they're decent and proper things for us to do, and it's about our identity. It's about us, we Australians. And we should tell politicians to stop running referenda with general elections. You know. They're too highly politically charged. It's the wrong place to do it. You know, we're not broke. We can afford separate referenda. We should make, you know, we should get in the habit of saying midterm, between general elections, we're having a referendum about X or Y. You know. So we can all think about it rationally and sanely without some hysterical politician chasing you for your vote. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for coming, and I hope these few thoughts might stimulate you into action.
If anyone would like to ask a question, you're very welcome to come to one of the microphones. There are two downstairs and there's one upstairs. I think that that's been a very sobering and stimulating address today, Mick, and I hope that we will have some questions. I think I could see one coming.
Just a clarification question. I noticed that when you started your speech, you paid homage to the first Australians, and you didn't, which is correct according to me, not the traditional owners. Could you explain that, please?
The term traditional owner is used in a number of pieces of legislation throughout Australia, but it was first used in the federal law that is the Northern Territory Land Rights Act. It speaks of traditional owners and has a definition of traditional owners. To some people, it's an artefact of anthropological thinking that's been grasped by lawyers and put into legal form and doesn't truly reflect the status in the way that First Peoples or First Australians or First Nations does. Again, it's like native title. It's something that came over on the ships. It's not about our status before those ships arrived. Whereas First Peoples or First Australians, we weren't called Australia back then. But we know when we say First Australians, everybody in this room would know who we're talking about. And there are some, like I say, there are some Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who object to that term. If I was in the Northern Territory, I would say traditional owners. If I was in Victoria, because the Victorian government now has a Traditional Owner Settlement Act in relation to land settlements in Victoria. And many Kuris in that state are comfortable with that term, but there are other people who aren't. So I was not just using a neutral term, I was using something that talks about, I think, the true status question.
I'd just like to bring up the question about, you sort of wavered against a new constitution, but I think it's a very good time for bringing that up and talking about those open things. As I did put the question to, I think it was the same Professor Williams, a constitutional lawyer, and it was just the wording which is on the website about having constitutional change, and it sort of says that our constitutional framework was governed and is for free and democratic nation when Indigenous people were not given those opportunities and they were excluded from the involvement of the formulation of the Constitution. So he actually called that blindness, I'd call it deception, and these are the things that are on the website asking us to look at, which I think are deceptive, and I think it's sort of a wrong approach, and we should go beyond that and look at a new constitution. Thank you.
I'm not going to disagree with you there. That is the same Williams, George Williams, the constitutional lawyer. George has written a bit about this and said a few things about this. I don't agree with him entirely about a lot of those things. But then again, we're lawyers. Our job is to disagree.
Professor Dodson, would what you outlined today be achieved if we were to follow New Zealand and have a number of Indigenous peoples directly elected into the federal parliament?
Yes. New Zealand's can be distinguished from us in their legal and constitutional arrangement. They don't have a written constitution. A lot of their constitution is through convention. And they have a treaty, of course. It's been elaborated and solidified, the Treaty of Waitangi, in legislation. And they have a bicameral system. They don't have an upper house. So they're the differences that they have. I don't have any problem with reserved seats as a proposition, but I don't think it's a proposition we ought to be dealing with in this referendum. It's again one of those questions we need to deal with down the track, maybe in a new constitution, where we've got the room and space to have a proper debate about it, and it's not bundled in with general elections and other referenda, that we actually have some clear air to fly in or a bit of blue sea to navigate through. When you bundle up with other stuff, tends to fail, and our record shows that, you know. I mean, if you're a corporation trying to change its constitution to fit in with modern practices and new technology, and you had the sort of record we have of changing our constitution, you'd have been out of business long ago. But, you know, the place to put that would be in 25, or perhaps not 25 exactly, but in that chapter, which deals with election two and constitution of our parliament.
Professor Dodson, I guess I'm partly offering a view, and it's not from any great thought, but just applying some general principles. I think the referendum question should be kept very simple, and the argument should be kept very simple. We should stay, if we can, out of the, if you like, economic impact on individuals, if people are worried about that. We should have some very strong arguments that go against those views, which I think will be around. I take an example of the carbon tax, or take the carbon tax as an example. I think the Gillard government's struggling to get the message across because it's complex and because people are worried about their back pocket, hip pocket nerve. So I think we could probably draw a lesson out of that. I remember the freedom marches of the late 60s, sort of early to mid-60s, I should say. And I'm thinking, again, I haven't given it a lot of thought, but I think we need a long lead time to sell the message, not just a blitz, advertising blitz, you know, 2 months. And I wonder whether we could perhaps take a leaf out of the of that earlier period and introduce something like that, because as a young man, that appealed to me. And as I think more mature Australians now, I hope it will appeal to many others. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, we've got to get the process right, and we've got to have enough time to build the confidence, to raise awareness and build confidence in people. They'll be free. No, I think they feel they're making an informed decision. I mean, the question should just be, you know, do you agree with inserting the words attached into the constitution, yes or no? And you shouldn't split the question. You shouldn't say, do you agree with the preamble, do you agree with changing subsection 26? They've got to be joined together. You can only give one answer to the question.
Yes, for Professor Dodson, it just seems to me like a no-brainer, this constitutional consideration and the referendum. I mean, if we've got a constitution which at the moment enables Australian governments to prepare and implement discriminatory laws like the emergency response law and and to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act, it's pretty obvious that there's direct discrimination, overt discrimination associated with our constitution. And it just seems to me that it's black or white. You either agree with discrimination or you don't. And it just seems like a very simple process. Why are we having all this argument about preamble and stuff? I really don't know. And I note that Justice Kirby, for example, spoke to the Law Council a couple of weeks ago, and he made a comment along the lines of, when we voted in the 1967 referendum, which I did, we never thought that we'd ever see a Racial Discrimination Act being suspended as it was and having the soldiers go in and God knows what, and really imposing a very patronising system on Aboriginal people. I mean, we've really gone, I think, gone wrong, but I think it's a black and white question. We discriminate or we don't. We either admit it or not.
Yeah, I think it's particularly in relation to 25, you say, do you want to repeal this or not? You know, yes or no. If you say no, you're actually supporting a racially discriminatory provision in the Constitution. And no doubt some people will say no. And may not because they may not be because they're racist, but because they just don't trust government on anything.
Let's go up to the gallery now.
Thanks very much. I'm not sure if this is on.
Yes,
thanks
it
very
is.
Much for the talk, Mick. I was just interested to see, trying to balance the positive, so-called negative aspects of making a decision solely about Indigenous people. And you've got to balance the tension, I think, between sort of neglect and the possibility of abuse. And I'd be interested, you mentioned the possibility of the word beneficial decisions to Indigenous people being acceptable. I'd just be interested in your thoughts on who would decide whether it's beneficial or not. Because I think that comes down to the crux of the question. I'd be interested in you talking about that.
Yeah, well, ultimately, the arbiter of the meaning of the words in our Constitution is the High Court. And I think they've done a pretty good job up till now. And they can, of course, overrule previous rulings with subsequent judgments. So there's a safety net in a sense. but there's a huge amount of international human rights jurisprudence around these questions. You know, they would guide our High Court. The international community has been dealing with this particularly since the Second World War. The Human Rights Council, in its former incarnation as the Human Rights, the UN High Commission for Human Rights, their committees have been dealing with all of these questions. I'm not wedded to that word, and you know, but you can't. You need to be proscriptive, but not prescriptive, if you know, in the Constitution. So it's got to be strong language, but it can't bring in, really is not useful to bring in, trying to confine the court in its interpretation. What you want to do is to stop the court from saying, yes, these laws are valid even though they're racially discriminatory or discriminatory in some other way. You know, and perhaps that might need eventually a provision in the Constitution that prohibits racial discrimination or entrenches the principles of equality and non-discrimination. But I don't know, that's not a debate for now in a sense. The preamble, you know, if there's a new preamble that is in the terms that I suggest without any qualification, they will aid the judges in interpreting, and they'll look at the debates in Parliament. They'll look at the second reading speech. They will look at the vote and say the people voted. This is what we thought we did in 67. You know, that we were voting for the Commonwealth to make beneficial laws. But the courts didn't take any notice of that. They went back to what the bearded white men of the 1890s and their conventions had in mind, not what modern Australia has in mind and what the Australia of 1967 had in mind. I'm sure, including the gentleman who voted, who spoke earlier, who voted in that election, I'm sure, you know, he can answer himself, but I'm sure most of them thought they were voting for beneficial stuff, not for the racial discrimination to continue through the parliament.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up. It's flown very quickly today, and I think that's been a fabulously thought-provoking lecture. Thank you very much for coming today, Professor Dodson, and I'd like you to join me in thanking him for his... See you all again next time.